accession number 20806, Reel 2.
Les Harvey, Reel 2.
I realised that I'd got to get out of the aeroplane, and but to my amazement, I could get no response from my feet, which were up on the rudder pedals. And no matter what I did, I couldn't get out of the aeroplane. And the next thing I remember was fresh air on my face, to my amazement, because I knew we were very low and I'd long since given up any hope of getting out. But I must have been thrown out, as I pulled the ripcord, the parachute opened, and I looked up and it was burning round the right-hand side. And I thought, my goodness, I hope this is going to last for a few, until I hit the ground. And as I looked to see where the ground was, I hit it. So I have no sensations of falling in a parachute at all. And of course, by this time, I'm sitting on the ground, naked from the navel downwards. My trousers had gone, boots, gloves, battle dress top. I was practically naked. And at that moment, I heard the noise of a tank. And I thought, oh, just my luck to get caught and taken POW now after getting away with this. But first of all, I was looking at my feet. I was fascinated to see that I sat up and wiggled my toes, everything worked, and my legs both worked, everything was working. And I just couldn't understand why I'd had all this hassle in the aeroplane trying to get out of it. And here I was sitting on the ground, and except for burns on my right arm and right leg and my face, apart from that, I was physically okay. I started to walk, but having no shoes, it was a painful experience. And a short while later, I heard the noise of a tank. And it turned out to be an Italian tank, which went by about less than 100 yards away. But it didn't see me, fortunately. And a short while after that, I was approached by some Arabs with camels, and they put me into a Arab, what they call a galabia, which is like a nightshirt, and put a turban on my head and put me up on top of a camel. And after a couple of hours with them, we were approached by, I think it was either the 10th or the 11th Hussars. They had a honeydew tank, which they were using as a mobile OP, observation post. And having established my identity, they put me in this tank and took me down to the coast back to their mobile column, where they had a mobile dressing station, and the medical officer there was very kind and put my face in a face mask and tended to my burns, the arms and the legs, and stayed the night with them. And the following morning, we were taken down to the coast to Benghazi, and I was set up in an RAF medical unit which had just arrived from England. But there my troubles really began, because in the afternoon an orderly came in and said, "Everybody out, the Germans are coming down the road." So we went outside. Sure enough, we could hear the sounds of gunfire and what have you. And after about 20 minutes, it all went quiet. And the orderly said, "Everybody back inside, false alarm." So we went back into this building where we were lying on stretchers on a marble floor. But that night, or the early hours of the morning, the orderly came in and said the same thing as he did in the afternoon. Everybody out, but this time it's for real. Of course, when we got outside, there were ambulances sitting outside, and being a walking case, I sat next to the driver. And after a few moments, we set off up the pass on the, with the escarpment, it was his known. And I was rather perturbed to find that as we were approaching the bends, it was like being in Italy. Very, very steep roads climbing up onto the escarpment to the top. And we had to give way to all the ammunition trucks which were coming down. And as we were coming to a halt on these hairpin bends, I was looking out to the left, and in the moonlight I could see the wheels were about 6 inches off the edge of a 300-foot drop. And I said to the driver, "Do you realise how close you are to the edge here?" "Oh, yes, sir," he said. "I've been up here thousands of times. But it's the first time at night with no lights." So eventually we get to the top, and we do end up at Tobruk, which is a great big army tented hospital. And I was in there for a week or so, and all my burns were healing beautifully, except for the arm, which was very, very slow. But to my mind, it was a waste of time in hospital. It could easily have been attended to at a sick quarters, if only I could be returned to an RAF unit, which I was eventually, because I'd noticed a DR rider in the camp, and I said, "Where are you from?" And he told me, and I said, "Well, look, I'm going to back inside and write a letter. I want you to take it to your CO, and I want an RAF medical officer to come out here to try and release me from the army," which he did. And about till the following day, people and commanding officer and an RAF medical officer came with him. They went in to see the army chaps, and eventually the whole thing solved itself and I was released into the care of the RAF. But not before I went a little ahead of myself. I should explain that I was worried about a very valuable camera which my father had given me and which was in my kit back at the squadron. And I heard the squadron were only 100 miles away. So I said to the army medical officer, "Could I go back to my unit, hitchhike at the lift, try and get this camera out of my kit, and then come back?" And he agreed to this, provided I was back at midnight, because apparently I was scheduled to go out on a hospital ship to Alexandria, to a big base hospital. Of course, I got the hitchhike back to the squadron, and of course everybody were wildly excited, a great party developed, and I said to the CO, "It's no good, I've got to be back at midnight to catch this ship, the hospital ship. Don't worry, we'll go back in the morning." I said, "The morning's going to be too late, if they sail at midnight." And everybody got so drunk, nobody could drive. So of course it was the following morning before we went, and of course when we got back to Tobruk, the hospital ship had sailed, and I'm full of apologies to the army. And they said, "Well, don't worry, you're lucky. The hospital ship was torpedoed when it left the harbour. And we lost 1,600 people. So, there, but for the grace of God, go I."
On checking your logbook, I find that that incident where you bailed out was not the 12th of January, it was the 14th of January.
That's right, yeah.
And it says wing sweep between Agadabia and El Agheila.
Mm-hmm. That's right, where's the 14th? Did I say the 12th?
No, I said the 12th.
No, where's the 14th? Sticks in my memory, vividly.
So what happened next, after you missed the fateful hospital ship?
Mists of time. I have to stop and think now.
Well, according to your logbook, in June of 1942, you're at aircraft delivery unit in Bombay.
Yes. Eventually, after missing the hospital ship, I was put on the train, and went by train back to Alexandria. to the base army hospital there. Then I was transferred to an RAF unit in Cairo, Central Medical Board, declared fit for flying again, and owing to the fact that I had so much time with Spitfires and Hurricanes, they were bringing out Spitfires and Hurricanes from England, from Liverpool, they were shipping them out to West Africa, to Takoradi. And they needed pilots to fly down and bring these aircraft up the route to replace the aircraft which had been lost in North Africa, and of course subsequently Sicily and Italy. So I was transferred to what was known as Number 4 Aircraft Delivery Unit, 4ADU, in Cairo, which where they were based in Cairo. We lived on a houseboat on the Nile. And then we were flown down as passengers by American air crews in Dakotas down to West Africa, to Takoradi, to collect or to test these aircraft which had been arriving from England, to air test them and then fly them up the route, which was a 6,000 miles run, up to Cairo. So I think it was, you'll see from my blog book, I think it was over a year I was doing that. Until the very last trip, of course, when I collected malaria.
You got what?
Malaria.
How did you get that?
Mosquitoes.
In West Africa?
Yes. Gold Coast, rampant.
Weren't you checking anything against it?
Oh, yes. Yes, every trip we went up. Had to go into sick quarters and had blood tests, what have you. But I say, I did it for a year. And it wasn't until the last time that I found that I was positive, or tested positive. Went into hospital there with it. And was sent up from there, convalescent. I flew up as a navigator in a bow fighter.
How did they treat you for malaria?
Oh.
What kind of treatment did you get?
Well, it was hospital treatment. I can't remember exactly what the treatment was. Using, and of course, quinine, and later that was replaced by mepocrine, which was, I believe, a synthetic form of quinine. It was taken in tablet form.
So,
but I remember lying on the bed there and sweating profusely. Very uncomfortable business. Whilst the fever lasted.
So what job were you given once you'd recovered?
I was back on flying again. Resumed flying.
Which squadron was this?
Well, it was the same unit with number 4 ADU. Subsequently, of course, when they invaded Sicily, they formed another unit, and that was known as number 2 ADU. Yeah, number 1 was the Takoradi one, and number 2 was the one which was formed for the Sicilian and Italian campaign. And we used to operate all from various airfields around Tripoli. To fly the aircraft across via Malta. It was rather hairy, that experience, because once you landed with the aeroplane, one had to make one's way back across the Mediterranean as best as one could. Hitchhiking, normally. I only did it once. I got hitchhiked on a blood wagon to Kota, full of army chaps who had been badly wounded. And it was such a hair-raising experience, I swore never again would I go on a blood wagon, as we called them.
What was so hair-raising about it?
There's the screams of the wounded and the injured, and the suffering going on.
Was there any danger of the enemy attacking you whilst you were doing this aircraft delivery?
Oh yes, I was attacked, well not attacked, I was landing at Salerno just at the time when the Germans were launching a counterattack. I remember coming into land with a brand new Spitfire Mark 9. And as I came in on the circuit, I noticed red Very lights going up. And I thought, well, I wonder what all that's about. Anyway, I landed. A flight sergeant came tearing up to me and said, didn't you see the lights? What are you landing here for? And I said, well, I've just bought you a brand new aeroplane. He said, you can set fire to the thing, but the Germans are over the other side. He said, we're evacuating the place. So he said, you better make your way down to the beach. So, of course, I did. I had what we call a stick bomb and stuck that in the fuel tank, and the aircraft was torched. I thought it was such a shame, a brand new one, because with the Germans, the risk of it being captured by the Germans, it had to be torched. Made my way down to the beach and was evacuated by Americans in a tank landing craft to Palermo. And then having arrived there, I hitchhiked across by road transport down to the south, down to Pechino, and from there I got a lift somehow or other across the Med back to Tripoli again. But that was a close-run thing of getting captured by the Italians.
By the Germans?
By the Germans, and well, the Italians. You were operating at Salerno, but it was mainly Germans, I think, at Salerno.
Any other incidents that happened to you whilst you were in Italy?
I can't recall any particularly. Oh, except one instance I remember, it's a very pleasant memory. Nothing to do with the enemy at all. But I was taking a brand new Spitfire 9 from North Africa over to Italy. And on the way, I suddenly realised I was passed bang over Mount Etna. And looking down, I saw smoke coming up. And I thought, I'm trying to remember my school days, whether Mount Etna was dormant or not. And I thought, well, I'll go down and have a look. And I found myself going inside the crater. And it was quite an experience. I put it into a really steep turn, and I ended up inside the crater, doing these vertical turns inside the crater itself. And then I decided it was about time I resumed my course. And I climbed up out of the crater, and I was absolutely astounded when I looked at my starboard wing, and there was an American P-47 Thunderbolt fighter sitting right on my wingtip. And I thought, thank goodness it wasn't a 109. I don't know where he came from. But the next thing horrified me was the pilot pulled the hood back. And to my amazement, it was an American Negro. And I didn't realise that the Americans had Negro pilots. But to suddenly see a black face, Negroid lips, nostrils, and a oxygen mask, I was absolutely taken aback. And that man sat on my wingtip, and I threw the Spitfire around quite a bit. But no matter what I did, I couldn't lose this character. He stayed there with me, more so than any of my own RAF people would have done. He was an astounding pilot, and I would love to have flown back to his base and bought him a beer. It was a case of ships that passed in the night. I don't know who the devil he was, where he came from. But it's the most vivid memory that I have of the war.
Now, according to your second logbook, in May 1944, you were back in England with 567 Army Air Army
Corporation
Corporation Squadron.
Yeah.
Any memories about that?
Where was that at? Detling, was it?
Well, you put Chislett, Richborough, Chatham area.
That's right, yes, that was at Detling. I was stationed at Detling, near Maidstone.
Any memories of that job?
The fact was that I wasn't allowed then. There were so many pilots in the RAF that they didn't need any more operational people. And it was the devil's own job for me to find another job flying. They wanted to put me on the ground doing something, flying control or something. But eventually they said, well, we've got a job for you, searchlight cooperation over at night over London, or army cooperation, beating up gun sites and giving the anti-aircraft gunners some practice. So I settled for the anti-aircraft practice. Hence my arrival at Detling. And we used to fly down to the coast and wake up all the gunners who were sitting on the piers at Dover and all along the south coast, because they were getting so bored with little enemy air activity at that time. Now the thing was to keep these gun crews on their toes.
What kind of aircraft were you flying there?
Hurricane twos.
And then in July of 44, you've got 695 Squadron, another Hurricane Squadron.
Yes, that was doing a similar job. Where was that, at Aberporth?
Weybourne,
oh yes, that was up on the Norfolk coast. I wonder who that was. They were having problems there with the doodlebugs. And they wanted aircraft flying over the... They imported these, they were known as predictors, which were being imported from the States, which could predict the course of these doodlebugs which were coming in over the south coast. And we had to get up fairly high and come down to get the speed and simulate the speed of a doodlebug to calibrate these instruments. Of course, they were known as computers today, but in those days they were known as predictors.
Did you ever see any V1s whilst you were flying?
Not there, but later on in Belgium, I was flying one day over the Scheldt estuary. And suddenly I noticed something coming up out of the clouds at a colossal speed, and it was a V2 rocket. Not a V1, it was a V2. And that's the first time I ever encountered such things. I had no idea what it was.
It seems that you were in Belgium in the earlier part of 1945.
That's right.
With 290 Squadron.
Yeah.
What were they flying?
Spitfires. 5Bs.
Did you...
Again, it was the Army cooperation work.
How did you finish the war then?
As a flying control officer at Lüneburg.
What did that involve?
Oh, sitting on the end of a runway in a caravan, monitoring and takeoffs and landings.
Of all the squadrons that you served with in the war, which is the one that you have fondest memories of?
Difficult. One squadron is like another. '54, I expect. The early, the first one. The first operational squadron.
You were telling me earlier off the record that there was a moment of very good luck that you had at Aston Down in July 1940.
Luck, it was my life. I was supposed to be taking off at a practice formation of three. And I was down in the authorization book to fly number 3 position, which is on the left. I mean, as we were about to, just prior to taking off, the chappie he was supposed to be flying number 2, I think it was. So I think it was Sergeant either Jennings or Jenkins, I can't remember which. But he approached me and said, "Have you had much experience with formation flying with the Spitfires?" I said, "None, why?" He said, "Well, I wonder whether you change places with me." Because he said, I have, like yourself, very little experience. But he said, "What experience that I have had," he said, "I'm quite happy flying number 3, the position that you're in." He said, "But if you're agreeable, I'd like to change places with you." I said, "Well, that's okay with me, if it's all right with the flight commander." So he went in to see Prosser Hanks, who was our flight commander. And I heard Hanks say, "Well, if it's all right with Harvey, it's all right with me. But when you get to your squadron, you won't be able to pick and choose. You'll have to go where you're put." So we lined up, we changed places, and we taxied down. And whilst we were waiting to take off, we were waiting for Blenheims to come in. And I would explain that Aston Down, it's like the roof of a house. You stand at one end, start at one end, and come up over the centre, which is a ridge. And then you disappear from sight down to the far side. Whilst we were waiting for the Blenheims to come in on their long approach, and it was a hot day, of course, being July, and whilst we were waiting there, and the engine idling, and watching the temperatures were rising, and I thought, my goodness, we're going to be too hot for takeoff in a moment. But we did eventually, when the last Blenheim landed, it was supposed to go over and over to the far left and then taxi across back to its dispersal on the right-hand side, because it would be unsighted, the other side of this ridge. So we turned around and took off, the 3, in what we call half-span overlap. And of course, the person on the left is looking at the leader on his right. And of course, got no idea of what's approaching from his left, because he's so engrossed in watching the leader. And as we took off, I saw the wheels wheels retract on Prosser Hanks aircraft. So I took mine up. And at the same time, I noticed there at the corner of my eye that number 3 person was missing. Then I noticed a fire on the airfield, and a Blenheim standing up on its nose, also on fire. Hanks and I both landed. And when I landed, I rushed across and I tripped over something. And I don't know why to this day, but I stopped and picked it up. And it was the scalp of this Sergeant Jennings, who'd asked to change places with me. And I suddenly realised, oh my goodness, it's my own scalp I should be looking at. To my horror, the Blenheim standing there on fire with its tail in the air and the nose section had been decapitated. Or the pilot and the pupil had been both decapitated by the air screw of the Spitfire.